Coming up on Tech News Today, Steam drops the third shoe. Microsoft might steal Ford's CEO, and they're definitely trying to steal some thunder from Evernote. All that and more coming up.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Tech News Today for Friday, September 27th, 2013. Tech News Today is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free trial and 20% off, go to squarespace.com and use offer code TNT9. And by Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. Find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products and smartphones are worth at gazelle.com. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Tom Merritt.
I'm Sarah Lane.
I'm Maya Zakhtar.
I'm Jason Howell.
And this is the show where we try to put all the tech news that's worth listening to into one contextual environment and make sense of it for you. Start with the top 10 stories of the day. We call it the News Fuse. Although he hasn't spent his last day at work yet, Steve Ballmer held his last company meeting as CEO of Microsoft Thursday. He spent an hour talking about things like the Nokia deal and passing the torch to the next CEO. He even got a little sentimental playing Michael Jackson's Wanna Be Starting Something. It's the same song he played at his first company meeting in 1983.
Oh, God, it's hard.
I'm sorry, guys. I told myself I wouldn't do this. And then he jumped and he screamed. And then he ended his speech with "I've had the time of my life" by Bill Medley and Jennifer Warnes. And then he danced. And he screamed some more. Sarah, just take it.
Okay, all right. Why don't you sit the next couple plays out, champ? Intel still wants to launch a web-based pay TV service by the end of 2013. And executives are now looking for a strategic backer to help them fund and distribute the service, or perhaps risking scrapping it altogether. Google, Apple, and Sony, of course, been linked to similar services, though none of them have publicly committed to anything. Intel has yet to finalize a deal with major TV programmers, but the company has more than 300 employees reportedly working on the TV project and is currently testing a version of the service with more than 3,000 employees. Intel has planned on marketing the service under a on-cue brand as well.
All Things D says that Ford CEO Alan Mulally is now leading as a candidate to be the next CEO of Microsoft. It's far from a done deal, as Mulally and Microsoft have yet to enter any formal contract negotiations. But All Things D says the discussions have been serious. Steve Ballmer will be leaving his position as CEO within the next 12 months. We now join a more composed Tom Merritt.
Thank you, IS. BlackBerry reported a quarterly loss of $965 million, a loss of $1.84 per share. This isn't going to make me feel any better. Revenue fell 45% year over year. The loss included a write-down of $934 million for unsold Z10 smartphones. And if you exclude the Z10 BlackBerry, they still lost $248 million, or 47 cents a share. BlackBerry holds a tentative bid of $4.7 billion from Fairfax Financial to take the company private.
The Chinese government will lift a ban on sales of video game consoles, opening up the market to foreign companies in Shanghai's new free trade zone. China's State Council says that foreign companies will be able to sell consoles across the entire country as long as they've established production and sales operations in that free trade zone. Each console will also have to be approved by China's Ministry of Culture before going to market. Consoles have been available on the black market in China, though most gamers use PCs or mobile devices.
Oh, look, a historical event has occurred. Google's changed up its search algorithm to better handle longer, more complex search requests. The new version of the algorithm is called Hummingbird. No Nestle co-branding here, and actually launched about a month ago. The news is making the rounds because Amit Singhal, Senior VP of Search, told reporters of the news yesterday.
The European Parliament's Internal Market and Consumer Protection Committee voted unanimously to require all phone makers, they're staring at you, Apple, to sell the same type of micro USB charger with their phones. Apple is one of the only companies that doesn't already supply users with a micro USB connector. Apple does have adapters for its 30-pin and lightning cables. The committee still has to take its proposal to the council, which will then bring it before the parliament, which will have to vote to approve it before it becomes law.
The New York Times sources have some potential really good news for frequent flyers. A special U.S. Federal Aviation Administration panel is ready to recommend to the FAA that it lift restrictions on passengers that use their smartphones, e-readers, tablets, laptops, and other electronics during all points of flight, as long as they're in airplane mode with Wi-Fi turned off during takeoff and landing. Now, if the report is accepted, the changes could be in place by sometime next year, as long as the FAA works quickly to make things better for passengers. Ah, I cracked myself up.
Oh, that was funny. FAA quickly used it in the same sentence. Anyway, Tom Warren, that cheered me up. Thanks, Sarah. Tom Warren of The Verge reports Microsoft committed to a single app store for Windows and Windows Phone at its September 26th company meeting. That's the one that was all teary with Steve Ballmer. Mary Jo Foley's sources agree and say it might come with the next version of Windows after 8.1, which would come in spring 2014. And it might include some kind of Windows Azure role, such as compiling apps or hosting back-end code for apps.
Over at Cydia, Dish showed off a new app by home automation company Control 4 that can control the Dish Hopper DVR. The Control 4 app was developed by using Dish's SDK that allows developers to build in control of Dish's DVR into their own apps. Right now, the app is limited to controlling the set-top box, but eventually, it will include two-way communication for things like guide data.
And Steam, in their continuing ability to ignore our start time, announced right at 10 a.m. The third of their new announcements for the week. This time, the trifecta is completed with news of a controller. The device will work with all Steam games, feature haptics, a touchscreen, dual trackpads, and they say it will be openly hackable. This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Squarespace. You know we like Squarespace. You know I like Squarespace. I'm always going on about the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio because I use it for Sword and Laser, for my books website. If you use it too, we'd like you to check out some of the sites you've built with Squarespace. Send a tweet with a link to your Squarespace website and use the hashtag TwitSquarespace. We'll take a look. We could be choosing your Squarespace site to mention on a future episode of one of many Twit shows. And the cool thing about this is if you go onto Twitter, you can do a little search for Twit Squarespace and you can see everybody's sites. It's like seeing a gallery of all the people making great galleries and other great websites. Of course, some of the reasons you'll love Squarespace involve its ease of use. It's incredibly easy to use. Squarespace has an amazing support team. If you run into anything that you need a little help with, they're there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And they've won numerous industry awards. Most recently, they got a Gold Stevie Award for outstanding service. It's inexpensive for what you get. You get award-winning designs. You get mobile-ready responsive designs. You get the ability to just easily create a template, customize it, and back-end hosting. That's the key here. You don't have to install anything yourself. They're taking care of all of it. Even your domain name, if you buy a year in advance, it starts at just $8 a month and includes that free domain name if you sign up for a year. Search engine optimization, hosting included, as I mentioned. Why not start a trial with no credit card required? You don't have to give them the credit card yet. Wait until you're going to pay. Start building your website. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace and then you give them the credit card, make sure to use the offer code TNT9 to get 20% off and to show your support for Tech News Today. We thank Squarespace for their ongoing support of Tech News Today. They've been great to us. Squarespace, everything you need to create an exceptional website. All right, joining us now to discuss the stories of the day, we're happy to have Sean Hollister, editor from The Verge, with us on the show. Welcome back to the show, Sean.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. And I don't know if you've been on a Friday since Len Peralta started joining us, but Len's here as well to draw the stories we talk about as we go along. Welcome, Len.
Thanks a lot, Tom. I am excited to get drawing.
Now, of course, folks, if you're watching the video version, you can see the drawings in real time as we go along. I don't know if the audio folks realize that. You can watch Len draw them. Jason will show the drawings as he's making them. And at the end, we'll flip through them all. Len will show us what he's got. And one of them, sometimes two of them, will go up for sale. You can actually buy prints from Len of the stuff he draws. Let's get started talking about that Steam announcement, Sean. I know that was one of the things you've been following pretty closely. It is a dual trackpad controller. It's got haptic feedback. Steam controller is built around a new generation of super precise haptic feedback employing dual linear resonant actuators, small, strong weighted electromagnets. That's cool. It's got a touchscreen in the center of the controller, similar to what Ouya has. It's got buttons Every button and input zone has been placed based on the frequency of use. So it's not just that it has buttons. They've done a lot of studies to figure out where those buttons should be placed. In order to support the full catalog of existing Steam games, they built in a legacy mode that allows the controller to present itself as a keyboard and mouse. The Steam community can use the configuration tool to create and share bindings for their favorite games. That's how they're going to guarantee this thing will work with everything. And then it's hackable. This is the part I like. The Steam community and workshop contributors currently deliver tremendous value, they say, and they will meaningfully contribute to the design of the Steam controller. They plan to make tools available that will allow users to participate in all aspects of the experience, from industrial design to electrical engineering. So that's why they got rid of a lot of those folks like Jerry Ellsworth, is they're going to crowdsource that. They're going to say, hey, electrical engineers, you want to play around with this? We're going to make this open for you to hack.
So I'm still processing. Processing all this, but it kind of blows me away that the number of the things that they're doing here. First off, there's those trackpads that they're using in place of analog sticks, and I look at that and I think about the history of, you know, touching little circles on the 3DS, on the PlayStation Portable, and things like that. And even when they were physical, didn't feel like they added enough feedback. Didn't feel like they added enough input. But I think about this in the context of streaming games, and it makes so much sense. Typically, when you've got an analog stick and you're streaming a game from another part of the house or from the cloud or something like that, there's a huge amount of latency. You know, you've got to wait for the controller to pick up your input, and then it has to transmit that input across, you know, the wireless, and then get the signal back, and then transmit to you a streaming video frame of the game you're playing from a remote computer, which is supposed to be one of the big features of the Steam Box. Is if you've got a computer in the other room, you can bring it to your living room, you can bring it to your television by having a little streaming box that'll receive the signals. Normally, with an analog controller, you've got to push that thumbstick over into a dead zone before it starts recognizing your input. But with these precision trackpads, it's going to know where your thumbs are all the time. They're always going to be touching this interface. So as soon as you move just a little bit, it should automatically be transmitting that vector. It should lead to less latency. It should feel more like you're holding a real controller, even having a real game console in front of you, even when you actually don't, when it's in another room or when it's, you know, coming from the internet. So this is very interesting future proofing right there, just right off the bat. And that's the first thing that hit me. The haptic feedback, I'll have to see that and try that to believe that they can really make it feel like you have a real controller in front of you, but that opens up a lot of possibilities. And this bit about the touchscreen, normally with touch interfaces, you have to look at them. You have to look right at them and pick what you want very carefully, because touchscreen is designed to, as soon as you touch something, you immediately take that action, even if it's not necessarily the one you meant to touch, if you move just a little bit away. They're talking about making the touchscreen a button here. So you have to touch an area and then press down. So it'll wait to see if what you really selected was what you meant to select and give you that physical feedback. It's something I've been wanting from touchscreens for a long time. So I'm just processing all of that right now.
With all the announcements this week between the operating system, the hardware that's coming, it seems like just because anybody can make a Steam box, Valve wants to make sure they have control over the way you're actually interacting with the games. So just because Valve isn't going to be not necessarily making the only Steam box or the Steam OS powered box out there, if they can control exactly how you can actually interact with the games, that's intriguing. Because when I think PC gaming, I think keyboard and mouse. That's the first thing I think of. And to say we're going to have a controller that's going to work with all your games, that makes the Steam OS boxes in your living room a little bit more attractive to, I guess, more of the console gamers out there to say, wait a second, I do play those games over on my PC. This might translate well, or it might just get a whole different set of people interested in Steam OS, because previously they were thinking, I don't want to bring a keyboard and mouse into my living room. A controller, though, much more living room friendly.
I have to say that's actually one of the things that worries me a little bit, is they say it'll emulate a keyboard and mouse, but they don't say it'll emulate an Xbox game controller. And one of the big things that a lot of the PC games that come over from the consoles right now support is they support the ability to just plug in a controller, like an Xbox controller or a Logitech controller, or another one that supports a scheme called X Input, and just natively play the game exactly as you would on the console. And they don't mention that here.
I think what they're doing there, Sean, is they're throwing that to the audience and saying, hey, this thing's configurable. Here's the map. You want to make it work like an Xbox controller? Here's the map. Go do that. They're crowdsourcing that. That's my impression anyway.
I like that. I feel like that's one of the weaknesses of the approach, though, is that they're not saying we're going to provide you a turnkey solution at any point in this process with the operating system, with the boxes. They said they're going to have some hardware with this controller. They're not saying at any point we're going to give you something that just works in your living room and you can just play it and everything will just work. They're saying a lot of, well, it's going to be very open. It's going to be very hackable and you can do whatever you want with it, which is brilliant for people like me. But I feel like if they're going to have a real, if they're really going to compete with the video game consoles, they also need to have that turnkey solution. Maybe the hardware providers, maybe an Alienware or a Razer will bring that to us in a turnkey package. I'm not sure.
Yeah, and people are saying, well, they say it'll work with all of the existing games. The way it works with all the existing games is that mappableness, right? They say you can map it and it should work with it. They're going to put an API out the same day they release the betas. And by the way, the 300 folks who get the prototypes of the Steam console will also get prototypes of the controller. And the only difference, I think they say, is that the controller won't have the touchscreen in it. So it'll be slightly different than the one they want to eventually ship. I think what they're hoping is these 300 beta participants will really go to town and create a lot of this stuff. I think they're gambling that by the time you or I, as regular people, buy a Steam console in 2014, a lot of these questions will have been taken care of by the community who are really enthusiastic about this. We'll see if that happens for them.
Yeah. I think that would be great. And I'm hoping that's who they are picking. With their 300 lucky volunteers here. I hope that's who they're picking. But at the same time, I was hoping they would have had that figured out by now, because right now, right before the next gen consoles launch, now is the time they could really tell, they could really get people to say, well, maybe I should wait. Maybe I should hold on, not buy an Xbox One or PlayStation 4, put my money towards a nice PC with a certain set of specifications that would make it a nice Steam box, but they didn't release that set of specifications yet. So a lot of this is, wait, we're building this awesome thing. Here's what we've, here's how much we've accomplished so far, and it's going to be great, we promise. And I'm willing to wait, but not everybody is.
Well, you're going to have to, unless you get in on the beta somehow, or maybe they're nice to the press and send some stuff over. In the meantime, looks like Microsoft might be targeting Ford for their new CEO.
Yeah, so All Things D saying that Ford CEO Alan Mulally is now the top of the list at Microsoft to become its new CEO. Earlier this month, Mulally says he denied leaving Ford. He doesn't have any interest in that. That was earlier this month. But All Things D sources say that Mulally wasn't seeking the job at first, but now has become more amenable to the idea in recent weeks. Factors that might influence his decision: he keeps a home in Seattle. He used to be the CEO of Boeing, and so he keeps a house there. He wanted to return. He also was a close advisor to Steve Ballmer in that recent Microsoft management structure shakeup. He was advising Ballmer on how to actually put the company together. Earlier this month, Reuters reported that the Ford board gave Mulally the ability to step down before his contract was up. Microsoft's interest comes from Mulally's ability to turn a company around, because before Mulally was at Ford, Ford wasn't doing as great as it is right now. Other candidates for the job: there's former Nokia CEO Stephen Elop. Obviously, he came along with the Nokia acquisition. Former CEO of Skype is now at Microsoft, Tony Bates. He's a potential candidate. And Pivotal CEO Paul Maritz is also another candidate, but Mulally's on top right now. Sources say that Mulally hasn't entered any formal negotiations. He's just having talks right now. And Bill Gates is on the special committee when it comes to picking a CEO of Microsoft. As everyone knows, he's a co-founder, one of the largest shareholders, but he is on that committee to determine who's up next. Sean, should Microsoft be looking outside the tech world for its next CEO?
Yeah, I feel like it should. I feel like the people that are within who are likely candidates have been, I don't want to say, compromised in one way or another, but it seems clear that there's been a lot of shuffles because there isn't so much faith in any particular one of them to lead up any particular position of responsibility. And if you look at Stephen Elop, there's the question of whether, he was complicit in getting Nokia to the point where it needed to sell to Microsoft. And with Skype, there's the big, NSA wiretap business to worry about. I think somebody outside the company might be a more interesting fit. But I have to admit, I'm not that financially minded, so it could be all kinds of issues I'm not considering here.
I just think it's a strange move. Other than the fact that Microsoft has been talking to, or at least Ballmer has been talking to Mullally a lot, there's been a lot of press about those two discussing things, and Microsoft did that management shakeup. And the idea, if Mullally's actually influencing the way Microsoft is being set up to run for the future, he would be able to kind of walk in to a place that he kind of helped structure in the first place. So if he does walk in, it would be intriguing. Although I wonder if that would burn any executives that are already at Microsoft for a long time, because although I guess they would have the idea when they did the management shakeup that they weren't being promoted above being like Terry Myerson, who's now the head of the Windows division, that kind of thing, or the actually operating systems. If they weren't going to get next in line as CEO, they do know their roles now.
It sort of seems like, I mean, not that any executive at Microsoft is absolutely unfit to be CEO, but Microsoft has a long history of so many departments and promoting people within the company over decades of work, and it's hasn't really served Microsoft well as of late. I mean, you can say, sure, I mean, it's had a long storied history of being one of the biggest companies in the world, certainly in tech, but it might just be time to do something that seems a little left field. I think the whole running Ford to running Microsoft is quite a leap, but obviously Mullally is a capable guy. He knows a lot of people over at Microsoft. Maybe it's just so crazy it might work.
He's an engineer. Let's not forget that. So a lot of people may say, like, well, what does this guy know about computers? He knows something. He's not a computer engineer, though. So he's got a similar mindset, but it's not somebody who's steeped in the history of Microsoft. It reminds me a little of bringing in John Sculley to run Apple. You're saying, hey, here's a guy with transferable skills who's done something like turn around a company like Ford. Microsoft needs to be turned around. We can handle the engineering. We've got strong engineers here, and he's got an engineering mindset because he is an engineer. So it should work. And it could work, but we all know how it worked with John Sculley. Now, that's one example. There's other examples of CEOs coming into situations where they weren't experts and doing a fine job. There's lots of Silicon Valley realizations of that sort of thing. You can talk about people like Meg Whitman. You can even look at Marissa Meyer, who didn't have experience running a company like Yahoo, and so far, so good. Jury's still out there, but it would be a risky move if they did it.
Yeah, but Ford's been really upping the technology with their cars. They just acquired Liveo for in-car apps, and I'm pretty sure Mullally did a keynote at CES, so he's been really involved in the consumer electronics space. So it might not be that crazy a leap. I think a lot of folks get hung up, like you were saying, Tom, that he's a car guy. But he's been putting technology forward when it comes to Ford.
If he did come over, I'm really curious what that could mean for Ford. If Ford would become even more technologically inclined, if it would start innovating even a little bit faster there. Obviously, Microsoft is not afraid of talking to its former execs after they switch houses. I'm wondering if they might do the same in reverse, you know, same thing where there was a Nokia partnership with Windows Phone and that became very tight-knit. I'm curious if they could channel a little bit of that energy back to Ford if he did come over.
I guess we'll find out just how apt the analogy that your car has become a computer platform actually is if Mullally takes over Microsoft. It would be an interesting test case of that sort of thing. Let's talk about Microsoft particularly expanding into a little bit of Evernote territory, Sarah.
Yeah, so we're trying to figure out who's going to run the company, but the company is still churning out the features. Sources tell The Verge that a new app, which is codenamed Office Reader, which is an amazing name, is a cross-format tool for a bunch of different types of content. Microsoft's Kirk Koenigsbauer showed it off at an employee meeting, says the updates are coming to Office in the Gemini wave in 2014. So what we see is a Windows 8-style app, so it supports web pages, Office documents, PDFs, ebooks, and textbooks, includes library sources and recommendations sections. Ability to navigate through PDFs easily on a touchscreen is apparently a big part of the focus, plus stylus support. Surface Pro Pen will let users do things like circle and underline and highlight and make notes on any document. The Office team has also partnered with Bing. I love the way that that's worded, you know, as if they're not all sort of the same company, but partnered with Bing to augment document content with data from within Bing. So let's say you select someone's name or a particular section of some sort of a document. Then you would receive information on some sort of a sidebar that would pop out. And then results would be displayed in a way similar to Windows 8.1's integrated Bing Hero Search. So that's kind of interesting. You've almost got your sort of built-in dictionary slash encyclopedia into documents. A couple other things. OneNote Capture Service is sort of a save-for-later service that works in the cloud. And then something called Office Lens for Windows Phone, which takes a picture of a whiteboard or something that's scrawled onto a piece of paper, basically longhand, and then automatically scans it and converts it using character recognition, optical recognition. Tom, you mentioned Evernote. I mean, that's the first thing that I go to when I hear some of these features. Evernote and, you know, stuff that Google's already doing. Sean, does anything jump out at you as, wow, Microsoft's really cracked this, or are they just keeping up?
I think it's really hard to say from an internal demo at a company meeting, you know, how far they've gotten this. But it really occurs to me, one, that my colleague Tom Warren is the fly on the wall I always wanted to be. But it also occurs to me that stylus support is the stylus might be making a big comeback. We've seen all kinds of interesting things from companies lately, from Samsung, from NVIDIA. They've got a new tablet called the Tegra Note that's coming out with a stylus built in, does all kinds of, you know, you can capture something on the screen and pull it anywhere. And now Microsoft doing a lot of that, all the character recognition, the text-to-speech and the speech-to-text that we've been seeing to augment the pen. I think that not for everybody, but for people who want to draw and to create things, that some of the stylus might make a big difference soon. And for Microsoft here, I feel like they're just going back to the Courier prototype and pulling a lot of the ideas from that fabled, you know, two-screen tablet that would have your stylus and you can just pull things over from one side to the other. I think they're pulling a lot of that. They're realizing that there were some great ideas in there that they need to bring to market in order to be ready for that stylus to come back into vogue.
Yeah, I think when it comes to styluses, Microsoft and the tablet PC, they've wanted, I guess, Styli for the longest time. I know my old Slate tablets had them, but the Surface Pro's had it since its launch. And I know of some digital artists that really enjoy using the Surface Pro as their all-in-one machine when it comes to actually drawing. The idea of interacting with office documents in a natural way, the way you're used to, or like just any, if you're going to carry just one device and you don't have to print out everything, a stylus just seems like a natural fit for that kind of thing. If Microsoft is providing the software, it might have other people decide, okay, yeah, we'll have a similar support. I just know when I was in school, that's what I would always do. I always did notes by pen. I didn't like using my computer to learn. So maybe this is targeted towards an older crowd like me.
That's what I always feel like, is that I'm just too old to understand. I don't use Evernote. I don't use any of these note-taking apps. And like you, I as, you know, 30 years ago when I was in school, I wrote things down. But I also didn't have a laptop. So, you know, that was way too expensive for a college student back then. So I just don't quite get it. I think that this is smart for Microsoft to get into. I'm not sure looking at this, and maybe I just don't understand it properly, this is the compelling reason to switch over from something like Evernote or Dropbox or Google Docs. It strikes me as a melange of things rather than a marriage of them.
I completely agree. And in a way, if there's one service that does all of the things that maybe you pick and choose Evernote or Dropbox or something in Google Drive as your solution, which is exactly what I do, maybe it's going to be attractive to a certain segment of the people who want to use the service to say, you know, what I like about Microsoft is it's just all in this one reader type of situation. But I just don't know how many people are going to even know about it enough to be convinced to switch over.
TV's Egon in our chat room says, something never heard before at work. Hey, the notepad server is down.
Not yet.
Not yet, exactly. All right, let's take a quick break and thank our other sponsor for today's show, Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can go to Gazelle right now and get some money, some cash for that new gadget that you've been saving up for. Right now, not all of you, but most of you are thinking about the new iPhone if you haven't gotten one already. And Gazelle.com wants to buy your used iPhone if you're looking to get rid of it. For a limited time, they're actually extending their 30-day price guarantee. They always have a 30-day lock-in. That's what I love about Gazelle is I can go as soon as I decide I'm going to get a new gadget, take the old gadget, put it on Gazelle, lock in that price for 30 days. But for a limited time, Gazelle is allowing you to lock today's pricing for your iPhone in until October 31st. That means you'll have a little extra time to get that new iPhone before you send them your old one. Gazelle makes selling your used gadgets fast and simple, too. That's why I use it. You go to GAZELLE.com. You tell them the condition. They're going to check it, but be honest, because they'll even buy broken iPhones and iPads. Get a risk-free offer, lock it in, get free shipping, and then you'll get paid fast by check, PayPal, or an extra 5% when you use an Amazon gift card. It's risk-free. It's trustworthy. I have used it. I have gotten my money. Go to Gazelle.com. Get an offer for your iPhone. Lock in today's price and send it in by October 31st. And do it now because your iPhone may lose value the longer you wait. Gazelle.com, we thank them for their support of Tech News Today. Okie dokie. So we mentioned in the news fuse, Google introducing the new Hummingbird search algorithm. Amit Singhal, Senior Vice President of Search, met with the press at 232 Santa Margarita in Menlo Park, California. That's Susan Wojcicki's old stomping grounds, her old house, where she allowed Larry and Sergey to set up Google 15 years ago, maybe today. I'll get to that in a second. It's kind of Google's birthday. Anyway, the Hummingbird algorithm launched a month ago. They didn't tell anybody about it. There had been some rumors about it. They say that in the month that it's been running, it affects 90% of worldwide searches, handles complex search strings better. And they also announced a few other improvements to the search product. Knowledge graph improvements, so you can say, like, what's the difference between olive oil and vegetable oil? And it will list the differences side by side. It'll give you side by side search results. On Android, you can now ask follow up questions using pronouns. Their example was you search for the Eiffel Tower, and then you can do a follow up search that says, how tall is it? And it knows you mean the Eiffel Tower. The Google iOS app will soon get an update to work more predictively, do some push notifications the way Google now does. It's not exactly the cards, but it does a little more activity than it did before. And as I mentioned, this week, today, particularly, Google is celebrating their birthday. Google itself doesn't say its birthday is today in its official timeline. If you go and look at Google history in depth, you're just going to see that September 4th is when they filed for their actual incorporation. September 7th is apparently when they received their incorporation. But about 5-6 years ago, they decided to move their birthday to September 27th. And they say it's kind of when they moved in the garage, but they won't put it down. Anyway, they made it their birthday. It's like Christmas. This is the day now. So kind of like making up a date for any kind of reason. What excites you more, Sean? The happy birthday to Google or the new search algorithm?
I have to say I'm most interested in the garage myth. It's just really fascinating to me that there's this really desirable notion that a startup would start in a garage as a particular place, you know, where a company needs to get started. You got to get started in a garage if you want to have some real street cred. And the idea that none of these companies start in the garage, start in somebody's brain. Perhaps a couple of people, they started during a conversation. Maybe they had that conversation in a garage. Probably not. I don't think a lot of people sit around their garage talking about it. Maybe nowadays, because they want to have a garage, you know, myth. They right. will proactively go into a garage and make sure they have, you know, okay, we're going to talk about companies, folks. We got to go to the garage. Let's go to the garage right now. But I feel like, you know. Then again, when I've been to garages, I went to the Apple garage, you know, it's not too far from me. I drove over there and you do get this sense of this humbling sense looking at this garage there, realizing that people were building components of the Apple computer in there. And I don't know.
And it's not a lie. Larry and Sergey did rent this garage for 5 months. It just they had been working on the search engine at Stanford for a couple of years before that, and they already had a few million dollars that they had cashed their checks for and then filed for incorporation.
I mean, that makes it sound so less mythical, so less interesting when you put that.
It's true.
Oh no, they only reinvented search that we use at every single day of our lives. And they bought operating systems. They were like, oh, we use also. It's also the dominant platform on mobile OSs. It's like the garage thing, I don't really – that's nice and that's pretty for books like this, you know, if you like chronologies of tech history. But I'm not so worried about where it started. I'm more interested in what search is becoming because I want to be able to find things. I literally just looked up on Google when is Google's birthday and there's no like knowledge graph card or anything about that.
Right, because there's no source on it. They just made it
Google
up.
Google itself doesn't have an answer for that question. That's, you know, you want to have Hummingbird and you want to have how tall is it when you're talking about the Eiffel Tower in a previous search. But if they can't even answer questions about itself, that doesn't instill me with any confidence in the search, although that's a bit facetious.
It's a good book, actually, that you picked up.
It's a fantastic book. And it's easy to, like, just pick up and then go, oh, I read that, and then you move on.
Yeah, September 4th is when Larry and Sergey filed for incorporation. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so I don't know. I think it's a legitimate garage, and it is that humbling experience you're talking about, Sean. Danny Sullivan, a while ago, actually, back in 2007, wrote, I think, the definitive article about how Google has moved their birthday around. And since that article, they've kept it celebrated on September 27th. I don't think it really matters all that much unless you're writing a book like I did. Otherwise, you know, it's happy birthday to Google, and keep improving the search engine. I think we all want that. We all want better search. The other thing to think about before we move on to the next story is, as they improve that search engine, if you notice, they're trying to keep you more and more in the search engine rather than going out to the links. So that comparison chart for the knowledge graph, for instance, you search for that comparison, you look at Google, and you're done. You don't have to click out. That's going to cause problems as the providers of that information start to get a little upset that Google really is starting to build a business on the backs of their content. That's already
been going on for years.
They've been being criticized about that for years, exactly. And now it's starting to
come. If they keep it factual, who really owns the knowledge? I mean, none of the sites that find knowledge necessarily own it. Even if I go and myself, Sean Hollister at The Verge, go and interview somebody and get a story out of them nobody's ever heard before. I mean, I want some credit for that. But if the facts are facts, I mean, I can't fault Google necessarily for just writing down facts that they've scraped from my story.
Let's move into the world of reality. Intel facing a harsh reality on the ability to launch a web television product. Ayaz, what's the latest there?
Yeah, so their upcoming TV services hit a snag. We've heard about Intel's plans to be basically a cable provider over the internet. All Things D sources say that Intel is looking for a strategic backer to help fund and distribute the service. And without a backer, the project might be scrapped entirely. All Things D says that Intel has been talking to Amazon and Samsung to help them out. Intel has no plans or actual deals with major TV programmers. And as Sarah mentioned in the News Fuse, there's over 3,000 Intel employees trying out this service internally. It's been called, it's going to be branded under the OnQ, or would have been branded under the OnQ brand. And it would have, like I said, traditional pay TV that competitors have, but it's delivered over the web. Cloud-based DVR that automatically provide access to any program that has aired in the last 3 days. And because it's a called on queue, you wouldn't actually have to program the DVR because Intel is recording pretty much everything. Sean, should Amazon or Samsung get entangled with Intel to rescue this over-the-top solution?
I've never heard anything to convince me that this Intel idea is going anywhere or that it exists beyond a limited trial inside of Intel. I mean, it's never been formally announced. It was just something that some reporters heard about and decided to publish in, you know, the Wall Street Journal and things like that. I'd love to have a service like that, but do I have any faith that Intel's going to be the one to provide it? Not really.
I've always been curious why Intel thinks they're the ones that can do this, right? Because the problem is not the hardware. The problem is not the technology, and that's where Intel probably could exceed other people theoretically. But the problem is striking deals. The problem is having leverage with the content companies that will force them into an agreement for you to carry their content. And Intel has absolutely no leverage, and we're seeing the result of that with where they're saying, well, who does have leverage? Let's talk to Amazon.
Well,
Let's talk to Samsung.
I'll chime in here about one thing that Intel does have. And Intel does now have a unique identifier in their chips so that they can be a integral part of DRM solutions to make sure that
TPM?
Content. Yeah, things like that. Things like that where they can, you know, they have a unique identifier such that they can ensure that the person who bought the content is the one watching the content. That's the one thing they do have, which I'm sure they'd try to use as leverage. They're in all of these computers. They've got a chance to be in tablets and smartphones going forward. So they've got a hardware base and an ability to say, we can protect your content if you partner with us. But beyond that, I don't know what Intel has really.
Yeah, it's a fair point. I'm not sure how much leverage that gets them, because if I'm a content creator, I just say, like, well, I've got lots of other ways to protect my content too. And maybe they are so salivatory about DRM that might mean more to a content company than it means to me.
I think both those companies make sense. Amazon with its previous content deals, Samsung trying to do everything and anything. If it's going to compete with Apple's mythical Apple TV, whenever that comes out, if they had a foot in the door because they have their hardware partner with Intel and Amazon is backing the content because they don't have a set-top box either. If all those things are together, you could probably have a pretty killer service if they could pull this together. I don't know why Intel suddenly needs to scramble for cash. Other than the fact they're probably just not allocating enough resources to do this service, because who knows how viable it'll be, because all the reports have been cable and all these content companies want the same deal or better than they're getting from cable companies and satellite, because this is an untested model. So it's going to require a lot of money to get these content deals at all. But Amazon and Samsung and Intel all together could be a monster if they ever got together.
Just think, though. One thing Intel has that nobody else has is the name Intellivision.
If only they would use that.
Exactly.
I wonder if they even own that's a trademark name from
Coleco,
right?
Yeah.
So
right.
They'd have to acquire that, but yeah.
I think they could afford it. That.
Intellivision
please,
inside.
Intel, do that now, please. Hey, Sarah, I have been way behind on this one. I know that I often astonish you with how behind I am on certain trends, but
I
just installed Candy Crush for the first time today.
Today you did?
Yeah, this morning.
How many rounds of Candy Crush have you played, Tom?
I played one round of Candy Crush.
Just the one. Okay, just so you probably have a slight understanding of, oh, this is kind of a fun game. I get why people are into it. The thing with Candy Crush is, not only is it the most popular game for the company that makes it, King, which is based out of the UK, but it's the most popular game on Facebook by a wide margin. This is the game right now. Here's the story. King, parent company, is set to trade on, looks like it's going to be the NASDAQ exchange as part of a big IPO. They have already filed their pre-IPO S-1 paperwork with the Securities and Exchange Commission. They've actually filed with the same loophole that Twitter used, where you don't really have to tell anyone your financials. This is sort of a loophole for businesses that are growing really, really rapidly, keeping the IPO confidential, at least for a certain amount of time. Now, of course, King has been compared to Zynga. Zynga, again, made a huge name for itself with wildly popular Facebook games. Although Zynga has had a pretty rough go of it recently. I mean, it's certainly a fall from grace type of a story when you look at the company and where it was even just a couple of years ago. Some details about King, at least on its financials, that you can get from its growth. It was turning over about 300 million pounds, again, British company, at the start of this year of 2013. Games were played an average of 300 million times a month back in 2011. That figure now tops 30 billion. So extremely crazy exponential growth there. And then Zynga, which has roughly half as many users as King does at this point, has a market capitalization of $2.9 billion. So just based on comparisons alone, you think, well, King is on the up and up, right? But I think we've seen time and time again, these never really seem to have much longevity. The whole we are popular, this is trendy, this is a social game right now on Facebook, we've seen nothing that's ever really just stood the test of time. It's all very kind of cyclical and trendy and that sort of thing. So I guess my question for you, Sean, is there any way to spin the story that isn't a people who work at King want to just cash out quickly before we all stop playing Candy Crush?
I don't know. I think that's probably the way I'd spin the story personally is, you look at Draw Something, for instance. Draw Something got a nice big cash out and then its popularity faded away, and you look back at Bejeweled and Peggle and games like that, and they had a little bit longer popularity than Draw Something, but still, games just this is what happens with games. You can build more and more sequels and keep people coming if there's new and different experiences, if there's in story-based games, to find out what happens to the characters they love and things like that. But when it comes to something where it's a very simple mechanic and everybody's playing this thing, and they all, it's easy to learn and easy to master. When it's easy to learn and easy to master, and people master it, and they get bored of it, they're going to move on to something else. And I just can't see, unless they've got something other than Candy Crush to keep it going. I can't see it going.
Candy Crush is extremely addictive. I was playing it quite a bit for a while. The problem that I find is that it's a very clear example of when in-app purchases just end up making me lose interest. Because some games you can play just fine. I'm doing a Tetris Blitz. I'm in sort of a Tetris Blitz K-hole these days. But you can play it without buying anything with real money. It just takes longer. And you know, you kind of trudge through certain parts of it. Candy Crush, actually, you hit a wall unless you start paying money. So that's where I find, you know, when you do something like that to people, yeah, you end up making a lot of money in a short period of time. But people will generally start losing interest because there are just so many other options.
I mean, even if you look at a series like Infinity Blade, I recently reviewed the third Infinity Blade game. And that game is a bit harder to master, and it's a lot deeper than a Candy Crush, I think, in terms of all these different slashing and all these different monsters that are coming at you from different angles, and you have to sword fight with all of these different creatures. And there's a story in there too. There's even books about the series. Even that, I'm starting to get tired of the idea by its third iteration. I don't feel like I would buy a fourth game in the series. They've got to give me something different now. And with something even more simplistic than that, like a Draw Something or a Candy Crush, I feel like its longevity is shorter.
There's a lot of money to be made in this business. And I think Zynga is probably the worst example of how to go about that. They were a one-hit wonder. And you have to be a hit factory if you want to make money in this. I don't know that King can be a more than a one-hit wonder either. So I wouldn't get in on this with any big expectations yet. But somebody will eventually, whether it's King or maybe Zynga turns it around or somebody else will start to be that one who you say, oh, they always come out with good stuff. They've got great minds in there and great developers. And so it's not just one franchise, but you can't, that's to me what the key is. You can't just look at a Candy Crush or a Farmville and say, oh, that's going to be a successful company.
Then again, there is Angry Birds as the counterexample. If you can build a franchise around cute characters that people want to have on all of their merchandise, then you can keep them coming.
But that proves my point, I think, because they didn't just have Angry Birds and that was it. They were able to spin that into lots of different kinds and piggies and cartoons. And so they weren't a one-hit wonder. They kept coming out with sequels. They turned it into a franchise, and that's a good way to do it.
I feel like none of the other companies' games have done it, though. It's not necessarily about the games. It might be around the larger marketing, the larger promotional effort, the larger merchandising effort. If you've got other things that people want, then maybe you can make it happen.
I still think, I mean, Angry Birds is, I think that, yes, it's the Pixar of mobile gaming right now, but I still don't think the next Angry Birds it's going to have diminishing returns. It has to. Nobody cares about Angry Birds that much, do they?
I didn't think Piggies would do anything, and it actually was more successful than I thought, so who knows? I would tend to agree with you normally, Sarah. I just don't trust my own instincts when it comes to pigs and birds. Something I've learned about myself.
Fair enough.
Let's move on to the randomizer. Straw poll today for the live audience had three options in it. The third was my favorite, and it only got 27% of the vote. Listening to Richard Feynman explain rubber bands will make your week. That's the headline from io9, and believe me, it will. I tweeted this out earlier. It's an awesome video. Number two, with 28%, New Zealand converting old phone booths into a national Wi-Fi network. Intriguing. But the winner at 45% of the vote, scientists create lightsaber material with photon binding technique. And honestly, none of you care how they did it. You just like the idea that Harvard and MIT professors may have discovered a way to create a nonlinear quantum medium, which lightsabers. That's all you want to hear. Right? Am I right?
Right.
I'm just nodding.
I think people want to see what colors are capable of this, really. I mean, if you're going to have light, is it all going to be the same color? We want to make sure that we have a color specified for each person as they had in Star Wars.
Yeah, need to have his purple Mace Windu lightsaber.
Exactly.
Very important.
So,
for those few of you who are like, I don't care about lightsabers, I care about quantum computing. That will actually be the first practical use of this, they think, would be the ability to form light matter. Come take photons and you make matter out of it and build more intricate chains of reactions combating against photons' ephemeral nature, which is a stumbling block for complex logical circuits in quantum computing, which is really easy for me to say right now. Shall we see what's incoming?
Incoming message.
Sure, why not? On rural internet, Tom, you are correct. The people out in the country do have options for rural internet. Poor and none. My mother, who lives in the middle of nowhere, an hour from Brainerd, has two options. Dial-up, Hello 90s, and satellite. Obviously, dial-up isn't an option, so that leaves satellite. The data caps, cost, latency, and overall speed barely makes it an option. The speed is so poor that when we often do a simple speed test of my phone against the computer loading Google Maps, even when my phone slips from 4G to 3G, it easily beats the satellite by 10 to 1. The rural market is ripe for disruption and is eagerly awaiting a viable option. Possible options are regional Wi-Fi using UHF spectrum, something, anything. If this actually happens, I would easily move out of the Twin Cities. On a larger scale, this would support job growth and a better quality of life for everyone. We all, at least the 2 million people that live in the state that don't live in the Twin Cities. That was from Mike in Minnesota.
Okay. I was just trying to give folks in rural areas more credit than they usually get. When that number was lower in the survey yesterday, it said 20% said they don't get the internet in rural areas, because my sister, who lives an hour outside of St. Louis, Missouri, in the middle of nowhere, actually has a local company that was providing direct access Wi-Fi to. Doesn't happen everywhere. And your grandmother is an example of that. And that's a fair other side of the argument to say, like, well, it certainly hasn't rolled out everywhere. But I think there's a lot more going on in those rural areas than people think. And my point was that they're not helpless out there. They're not just waiting for somebody to ride in and finally give them internet. There are some things in some areas going on, but not everywhere. So that's a good point. Thanks, Mike, for the email. And let's thank Sean for joining us today. Sean Hollister, editor at TheVerge.com. Great to have you on the show. What's been going on that you can talk about? Let people know what you've been up to over there.
I've been working a lot on a big report about Miracast that went up the other day. It's a technology you probably don't know about because nobody's actually using the brand, but a lot of the new smart televisions are rolling out with a system that will let you connect your phone to your TV over Wi-Fi and beam everything you see on their smartphone screen onto the big screen. And it has all kinds of different brand names. It's a competitor for Apple's AirPlay, but they don't have a unified branding scheme that's letting people know that these things are actually compatible with one another. And it's a source of frustration for me in particular. I'm really angry.
Good stuff. Miracast is interesting too. So that's an excellent piece. Check it out at TheVerge.com. You can follow Sean on the internets as well. You still going by Starfire?
Still going by Starfire 2258. I will not allow peer pressure to change my mind, but maybe someday I'll just change it.
Preaching to the choir with Ace Detect here, believe me. Thank you, Len Peralta, too, for being there and illustrating our stories today. What did you come up with?
Well, I did a lot of iconic sort of drawings today because I think a lot of the stories were iconic. The first story about Steam, did a little bit of a little drawing of Gabe Newell. At this point, I drew this. I didn't know what the actual announcement was, but all we had were those two little circles and the plus sign. So I turned it into like his glasses. And, you know, it's kind of iconic for Gabe the big announcement. So
it's really cool. I want a copy of that.
Oh, well, maybe that will be the one that wins and goes into the online store. Second story, is this the story? Yeah. Is Mullally switching sweaters? I guess, is it Tim or Tom Mullally? I guess he's known for this. Alan.
It's Alan, but that's okay.
He's known for his.
You're confusing
his
him with me
sweater.
And my brother.
There you go. He's known for his red sweater. And so the question I asked is Mullally switching sweaters? You know, the little Microsoft thing. Actually, he looks a little bit like a Walmart employee there. So maybe maybe that's not the best idea.
His new job is a greeter.
Exactly. Well, you know, you can't have a story about new stuff for Microsoft in Office without featuring Clippy. And I felt that Clippy was a little bit dissed here. So here's a little drawing of why develop spinoff app featuring Clippy.
Clippy's
why
been a little dissed throughout his life, actually.
Yeah, he's like the Jar Jar Binks of technology.
Yeah. Well, he's sort of asking the question here, and you know that's a good question. We should actually take that seriously. This one was interesting. I mentioned iconic. I sort of sketched this idea out for a Google Hummingbird. That's going to be the new name of their new technology for systems there for search engines. So this is the Google G in a Hummingbird format. So
that's really good. Awesome. They should like buy that.
If
from
Google
you
ever buys
that.
Twitter, you can always repurpose that.
Yeah. Isn't that cool? Yeah, yeah.
Slightly.
Well, yeah. come in. They're certainly welcome to talk to me about it. Once again, logos, very iconic here. Should Amazon and Samsung help out Intel? The most compelling reason Amazon and Samsung should help out Intel is because, from a branding standpoint, Intel's logo already looks like a love child of Amazon and Samsung, if you think about it.
It does. It looks like some kind of like health class graphic.
It's a little bit. Candy Crush has been the bane of my existence for the past 4 months. I'm not really necessarily interested in a King IPO. I just want a way to clear this blanking jelly. Which is really, if anybody plays Candy Crush, you'll understand what I mean. I hate the jelly.
I'm not ready for that jelly.
And then finally, the randomizer real quick. You know, I wish I spent more time on this one, but this is a scientist who's kind of turned into Darth Vader, sort of. Messing around in the lab with the lightsaber that he's created.
You don't know the power of the quantum mechanics.
Exactly. If you're live in the chat room right now, you can actually, there's a straw poll where you can actually vote on which one you'd like to see me turn into a print. There's some cool ones here that we can probably choose from. So go ahead and vote, and then after the show, I'll put one up there.
That's going to be hard to choose, man. Those are some good stuff. I mean, you always have good stuff, but these are great, man. I really, really enjoy these. You can find them at peraltartsy.my, is it my Shopify?
Yep.
Yeah. Or twit, bit.ly/twitlen. That's the easy way to go. Get.
And it's also linked at the top of our subreddit at technewstoday.reddit.com. That is another way you can not only get an influence on the show's stories every day, but find the links to Len's art. Go there. Yeah. Do it. Enjoy it. Also, thank you, folks, for continuing to send in your favorite moments. Do it all year long. Twit.tv/bestof, not just for Tech News Today, but any show on the network. Let us know so we can put them together in our best of shows at the end of the year. That is it for us. Thank you so much for joining us. You can find us on the web at twit.tv/TNT. You can email us at TNT@twit.tv. And you can give us a call, leave us a voicemail, 260-TNT-SHOW. We'll be back Monday with Ryan Shroud as our guest. See you then.